Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here, and we're going to begin our program today by taking a look at the archaeology of our state with Tom Plager, Dean and Campus Executive Officer and Associate Professor of Anthropology and Archaeology at the UW-Baraboo Sauk County Campus. And it's great to have Tom back. And certainly, if you have a question about the archaeology of our state, I hope you'll join in. Lots to talk about here. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org, and we'd love to hear from you. Tom Plager with us by phone today. Tom, hi. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
Hello, Larry. Always great to be on the program and excited to talk about Wisconsin prehistory and Wisconsin archaeology again.
Yeah. Have you been doing a little work this summer of your own? In the
We've been working on, with one of my colleagues, Janet Speth, a write-up from a field project that we did in 2006 in Tremplo County, but the campus, the University of Wisconsin, Baraboo Sauk County, held a field school over in Tremplo County this summer where we were working with the University of Illinois on some Mississippian sites and had students from across the state in that project, and I was able to get out and at least visit, but didn't participate directly in the excavations this summer.
We talked with a couple of folks last week about that project. It sounds like it was really interesting. How long have people been in Wisconsin preceding European arrival?
Well, we know that people entered Wisconsin at least 12 to 13,000 years ago. The earliest dates on archaeological or what are believed to be archaeological deposits associated with the Schaefer Mammoth site over in Kenosha County date to that 13,000 plus range of age, and I think most archaeologists are very comfortable with a 12,000-year prehistory, if not earlier, in our region. And it's amazing to think about that for 99.9% of that spectrum of time, or that passage of time, that we don't have any written record of the peoples that lived here, and that archaeology and the oral tradition of Native peoples are the primary way to learn about those cultures that preceded Europeans in our region.
Yeah, it really is amazing, and it's kind of sort of like a little, you have to be kind of a detective when you're an archaeologist, don't you?
Well, it is. A lot of the techniques that we use are similar to crime scene investigation. The complexity of archaeology, what makes it very different, is that the clues are buried. And in many cases, you have multiple crime scenes stacked on top of one another, so that complicates things. And then, of course, in some cases, thousands of years of natural processes that can change the geology and the geography and the topography, coupled with human interaction. So often it's a very complex process of collecting artifacts and clues and piecing together what happened in terms of the geomorphology or the landscape setting over a period of time to interpret how people lived on that landscape.
Are there things that are unique to Wisconsin, or is this is that kind of too much to ask in a way compared to, say, other states in the Great Lakes?
Well, Wisconsin does have an amazing archaeology and archaeological record. It's been attracting scholars for over 150 years. Some of the very first professional publications about Eastern North America that were published by the Smithsonian either dealt specifically with Wisconsin archaeology in the case of Increase Lapham's Antiquities of Wisconsin, or other publications that referenced the uniqueness of the archaeology of our state, and we certainly have some distinctive mound-building cultures. Effigy mound building, which is late woodland, is unique to primarily Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, and a little bit in Illinois. We have some of the oldest metalworking sites in the Americas located here in Wisconsin. So it's a state it's a region of the country that's attracted people for thousands of years because of our natural resources and beauty.
Yeah. Steve in Madison has a question or comment. Steve, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I had a question about the Isthmus here in Madison, just about the historical significance, just because of its geographic beauty and just in between two lakes like that. What exactly was the history behind that special spot that is the Isthmus?
Well, the Madison area has been attracting people for thousands of years. There are Paleo-Indian sites in the Madison area surrounding the lakes. And, of course, in late prehistory, Native peoples that were involved in mound construction occupied the Madison area extensively. The University of Wisconsin-Madison campus has one of the greatest densities of archaeological sites of any of the Big Ten campuses. It's a region where, obviously, you have a dense concentration of natural resources connected with the lakes. You have the Yahara River. It's an area that has been very attractive. And there's a great new book out by Bob Birmingham on the mounds of the Madison area that I would refer you to. I'm sure if you just did a web search on his name and mounds in Madison, you'd come across that, that details what we know about the mound-building cultures that existed in the Madison region.
Great. Well, it's a wonderful program. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. What differentiates we have prehistory from history in the Great Lakes region?
Sure. And I get asked this question quite a bit as an archaeologist. Sometimes people think of archaeology as history. And generally, there's a dichotomy or a division between prehistory and history. And in our region and throughout much of the world, but particularly in the Great Lakes, it's marked by the development of and the presence of written records describing peoples and their daily activities and interactions. And in our region, that's marked by the appearance of Europeans, first the French and English and later Euro-Americans and of course, the formation of our country. Prior to that, the archaeological record prehistory is limited to studying the archaeological materials, the artifacts, the features that people left behind, and there's no written account of these cultures. And so that's really the dividing line, is the presence of written records, and that coincides with the arrival of Europeans. Native peoples in eastern North America did not possess written languages or did not have a written language, written languages to record their history. There was some pictograph and symbolic representation of stories, but there's no written account. So archaeology or the accessing the oral tradition of Native peoples are really the primary sources for understanding what Native lives were like in our region prior to the arrival of Europeans and the records that they left behind.
You know, it'd be interesting to know, and maybe, or perhaps I should say, how much do we know or what have archaeologists learned about the changes in Native American culture after European contact?
Well, dramatic changes. And again, this window of time that Native peoples have been here for at least 12,000 years on the landscape and, of course, are here today. And you can see that through the archaeological record the development of new technologies and lifeways and increasing populations. But as soon as Europeans arrive, you see a widespread dissemination of European technologies, things like iron, even though Native peoples had been using metal in the region in the form of copper for 6,000 years, iron. It has the ability to hold a much more durable edge. It can be cast and mass-produced items. So you see the distribution and the diffusion of axes and woodworking tools and weaponry made out of iron, the importation of glass technologies, brass, as well as firearms, of course, alcohol. All of these are European practices and traits that entered into our region, dramatically changed Native peoples, their economy and their lifeways, and European diseases, of course, in the form of smallpox and other diseases that Native peoples did not have any previous experience with, swept across the Great Lakes region and caused dramatic depopulations in a relatively short period of time. So that window of 1634 up until the late 1700s, early 1800s, is really the most dramatic and pronounced changes that Native peoples experienced in the time period that they had been here in eastern North America.
Yeah. Tom Plager, our guest, Dean and Campus Executive Officer, Associate Professor of Anthropology and Archaeology at the UW-Baraboo Sauk County Campus, as we talk with him about the archaeology of our state. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. Sir DeMichael in Hillsborough next. Hi, Michael. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. It's nice to talk to someone from BU. I was there in 1970 and 71.
Hey, great to hear from an alum.
Thank you. I read a book not long ago about Colonel Custer and his adventures out by the Little Bighorn in 1873, and, of course, he came to a bad end. But he discovered a lot more hostiles out there than he ever expected to find, and it was posited in the book I read that they were still at a gathering point that was traditional for the summer solstice, which generally falls around June 21st. And, of course, he met his end on June the 24th, I think. So there's evidence in that end that there are these gathering points where the Native Americans celebrated events such as the summer solstice. And I'm curious to know if there's any evidence in Wisconsin that there were any places like that here?
Interesting question, and there clearly is connections between native peoples and celestial alignments and special times of the year, such as the solstices. We have a number of archaeological sites. Many of our mound sites seem to reflect this, certainly Aztlán. These times of the year may have been important, particularly for agricultural societies, to gauge the passage of time and to sort of mark the new beginnings of seasons or the harvest in the fall. And we do have a number of archaeological sites that have these types of alignments. Aztlán is one that certainly people gathered during these special times. And how far back it extends in time in prehistory, we don't know. But it was certainly present with the mound-building cultures that existed on our landscape.
Yeah. Horicon, that area was that a gathering place, or it certainly was a trade center, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, the importance was likely different during certain times in prehistory and the historic times, but that the Horicon Marsh area certainly has a significant number of archaeological sites, particularly mound-building sites, that it's a region that would have produced a significant amount of food in terms of the marsh wetland resources of migratory waterfowl and aquatic plant resources that people utilize that landscape for a long period of time. And there, as I mentioned, there's a fairly significant distribution of archaeological sites, particularly mound sites in that region of the state.
Yeah. Chris in La Crosse, let's turn to you now. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
I've been working in archaeology for years now. This has been about the two worst years I can remember for actually doing CRM archaeology. And I know it's not quite his field. He's not in the CRM, but I just wondered if he saw, a little better business in the coming years.
What do you mean by CRM? Tom, maybe you can explain.
Sure. The term CRM refers to cultural resource management, and I have spent quite a few years doing that type of archaeology. You could differentiate two major areas that archaeological research are done in our region and in North America. One is academic archaeology that's done predominantly for research purposes through universities, specifically for research or learning purposes. And the other is cultural resource management. Now, sometimes the two overlap and can go hand in hand and complement one another, but cultural resource management archaeology is archaeology that's done to comply with laws that protect archaeological sites and archaeological resources. And it's a way to manage and protect our cultural resources across the United States. And when you tend to see an increase in the amount of cultural resource management archaeology done, is directly related, in my opinion, for the years that I've been involved in it, to the economy, that when there is a lot of construction, a lot of earth moving, there is a need to do more of this type of archaeology to make certain that roads and housing developments and construction is done in such a way so that it has a minimal impact on important archaeological resources. So the archaeology that's being referred to by the caller is archaeology that is done to make certain that development and construction takes place in such a way so as to have as minimum of an impact on archaeological resources as possible.
I got it.
And that would not surprise me that we're seeing a slight decrease or maybe even a significant decrease in the amount of cultural resource management archaeology that's being done right now. But I would predict that as more road construction takes place and potentially as we see stimulus money entering the Department of Transportation funding and so forth, that as there's more road construction, that there could be more work done. So it comes and goes in cycles. And if we're at a low point now, as the economy improves, potentially you'll see more archaeology done.
All right. There you have it. Thanks a lot for calling, Chris. Tom Plager, our guest today. Anthropology. He's an associate professor of anthropology and archaeology at the UW Baraboo Sauk County campus. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll take some more calls here as we talk about the archaeology of our state with Tom Plager. And our next caller is Lynn in Rushford, Minnesota. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, thank you. I wondered if you could discuss a bit how you think the glaciers and the melting of the glaciers back 13 thousand years ago or so, could have impacted human life as well as other life in this area.
And the term that archaeologists used to refer to the very first native peoples in North America and in our region is the term Paleo-Indian or Paleo-Indian tradition. And it's divided into early and late stages. And the early Paleo-Indian stage refers to the peoples that would have been here when, in the case of Wisconsin, at least the northern third of the state was covered by ice, and certainly the upper peninsula of Michigan. And it would have been a landscape very different from what we're familiar with today, different types of plants and animals on the landscape, mammoth and mastodon, other megafauna species. There was a very large beaver the size of perhaps a small black bear in Wisconsin. The plant life would have looked different. And as these glacial sheets receded through a process of melting, you would have had a series of ecological zones that likely proceeded north and opened up new landscapes. So for people that entered Wisconsin during this time period, they were on the edge of the known world, so to speak, and it would have been possible potentially to visit this boundary between glacial ice and glacial runoff and then a series of ecological zones south of that. And people explored the upper Great Lakes as it became ice-free. So consequently, the oldest archaeological sites, for the most part, in the upper peninsula of Michigan are younger than the earliest archaeological sites in the southern Great Lakes and in southern Wisconsin. And this was a period of significant environmental change one that we know the peoples that were here were well adapted. Their technologies allowed them to be quite successful in this environment, but very small numbers of people in a very sparsely populated region, people moving constantly over very large distances.
Interesting. Thanks for calling, Lynn. And let's turn to Margaret in Delafield next. Hi, Margaret.
Well, hi there. Professor, tell me, have there been any findings of Indian mounds or paleo artifacts in the Kettle Moraine?
There are archaeological sites in the Kettle Moraine region.
Where?
There are quite a number distributed across the region. The Wisconsin the State Archaeologist's Office maintains a database. There are over, and it's been some time since I've looked at the total, but over 20,000 known archaeological and historic archaeological properties. That was some years ago. Known in the state, the number is likely significantly higher. But it's that office's job to maintain those records and to make certain that work done in the parks or in preserved state and public lands in the state of Wisconsin are done in such a way, work is done in such a way, development to preserve these archaeological sites.
Interesting. Thank you for calling. Mark in Iowa, actually driving through, I believe. Mark, hello.
Yes, good. Good morning, I guess it still is, or good afternoon anyway. Quick question. I drive up to Menominee from Waterloo, Iowa, three or four times a week, and I've noticed on Route 25, I think it's called the Waubeek Mound, W-A-U-B-E-K, and just the sheer size of that thing, is it an actual, you know, Native American mound in? And I guess if you know that for sure, and just a comment on, you know, the size of that thing, if that is indeed an Indian mound, is striking.
That name does not ring an immediate bell with me in terms of recognition of a mound. There are thousands of known mound groups or mounds in Wisconsin. We estimate about 80% of the original mounds that once existed are destroyed. I don't know all of the mound sites. That's a name that doesn't immediately jump out at me. But there are also some natural geological features that are sometimes given the term mound that may not relate to being constructed by human beings. From an archaeological point of view, when you use the term mound, we're referring to something that was built by people. And this is something I can't comment on because the name doesn't immediately draw up to mind a site in my recollection. But mound size varies significantly. Some of the largest mounds in Wisconsin in terms of conical mounds are in excess of 3 or 4 meters high and 60 plus feet across at the base, these large conicals, and they're even bigger in the Ohio River Valley area. And then, of course, some of our effigy mounds can be quite massive, of hundreds of feet in size. And so I I can't answer your question specific to this particular place because it just simply doesn't ring a bell with me.
All right.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you for calling. And we'll take some more calls. Let's go to Daniel in Rice Lake next. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. I've been to the Pipestone Quarry site many times, but has that ancient Pipestone Quarry site east of Rice Lake, sacred to the Native Americans, been extensively studied by archaeologists?
Good question. There are a number of pipestone sources in the upper Midwest. You mentioned the most famous, the Catlinite quarries in Minnesota, which produced a red, orangish-red soapstone or steatite-like material that was used soft and was often used by Native peoples for constructing or manufacturing smoking pipes and smoking pipes are found all over Wisconsin, particularly in late prehistoric cultures made from that material. There's also a quarry in northern Wisconsin that you mentioned, I believe in the Rice Lake area, that there has been some initial work done. I think John Broyhan, the state archaeologist, has investigated that. And the Baraboo area, also there are a number of places where there was a purple soft soapstone-like material that was also used by Native peoples for the production of smoking pipes. So we have at least three primary sources in our region, and there may have been others, but archaeologists are very interested in mapping out trade networks and the distribution of artifacts made from these particular locations to get some idea of how great an area Native peoples were interacting over at different times throughout prehistory.
All right. Thanks again for that call. Jeff in Superior, we're on to you now. Hi, Jeff.
Great. Thank you. I want to take you back to a time before there was contact with Europeans and the Native peoples here and their lifestyle. If they needed to eat or find something, they just went out and got it. And what I'm curious of is how do we assign meaning to their the things that you find in an archaeological site from that period of time where they would have meaning, such as a good luck charm or a religious item of some kind that to us would be, in our culture, something that would be a connection to them?
Excellent question. And the primary means for doing that is the discovery of archaeological materials in what we call primary context, where they're recovered in the ground in association with other artifacts that could allow you to make some inferences as to their function and their use. And then even better is if those materials are found in association with some type of organic material, charcoal or bone or something that can be radiocarbon dated. What you're looking for are patterns of association that can be dated and then observed in multiple locations to make some sense out of the prehistoric record. But the hardest types of artifacts, the hardest types of material culture, the things that people produced to get at and to understand are those that often have religious or ceremonial significance because their meaning can be lost throughout time. And without some specific finding them in some specific order or in situation where you could make some inferences as to their function, it's difficult to do. So the archaeological record is filled with descriptions of objects that are described as ceremonial, and often those are things where we believe that they have some religious or special purpose, but what exactly their function may have been remains a mystery. And that is truly, you asked a question about the hardest component of culture to get at in societies where you don't have a written record or a written description of the account and you're dealing only with the things that they produced, are questions about religion and ideology are difficult to interpret.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. What are the hottest topics going on in Wisconsin archaeology these days, Tom?
Well, a lot of interesting areas that are being investigated. Of course, the earliest archaeology in North America and in Wisconsin is always a hot topic of what are the earliest sites, when were the first people here, and what direction did they come from. the development of mound building cultures in our region, and particularly effigy mound culture, which existed from maybe AD 700 to about AD 1250, somewhere in that range, as to why effigy mounds were constructed. And there's a great deal of research centered around this, their function, their meaning, and what happened to effigy mound culture. Why did it stop in terms of a recognizable culture in the archaeological record around AD 1200, AD 1250 or so? And how are effigy mounds related or connected to historic Indian populations and ethnic groups? I think that's a hot topic. The Mississippian presence in Wisconsin, you referenced the excavations that our campus was involved with Robert Bozard, Ernie Bozard, and Daniel Benden at UW-Madison over in Trempealeau County and Tim Polkatat. The understanding of this influx of people from the American bottoms about 1,000 years ago who were foreign to the area and how they interacted with native peoples here in places like Aztalan, sites in Trempealeau and the Red Wing area, why were they built and what were these people who were not native immediately to Wisconsin doing up here and how were they interacting with the local effigy mound cultures and eventually what caused the collapse of sites like Aztalan and Cahokia and the American bottoms. Also another hot topic. And then finally, I think where we're really going to see some exciting research in the future is a greater understanding of connecting late prehistoric native cultures to historic Indian groups. And that's something that as we have new techniques and things like genetic analysis of skeletal material, where I think we will see greater resolution and a greater understanding of what historic Indian group is related to what particular archaeological culture and prehistory.
Pretty cool. David in Madison, we are on to you now. Hi, David.
Hi, thank you so much. Terrific program as usual. My point was that related to this, closer related, I'm reading a book now called Black Hawk. The name of the book is Black Hawk, of course, the Indian chief, the Native American chief Black Hawk, written in 2006 by a UW Manitowoc professor, history professor, who I think is recently retired, and his last name, I don't have the book in front of me.
Kerry Trask.
Oh, it's a fabulous book. He makes great use of you know, the archaeological evidence to put together just a marvelous narrative. Anyone interested in this history in this area of Wisconsin should read the book Black Hawk by this professor. And if you have anything to add to that insight that he offers, I'd appreciate hearing about that. Thank you.
Sure. Sure. The Black Hawk War, of course, is a well-known Native battle, really a tragedy involving the Sauk and Fox and some Meskwaki. Here in Wisconsin, that took place in 1832, really was the last Native battle or war fought, I believe, east of the Mississippi River, and eventually led to the opening up of Wisconsin for surveying and settlement and eventually statehood. And it's a sad story in terms of the loss of life on the Native American side and the condition that the Black Hawk's band was in. Very interesting story in terms of the dilemma that Native peoples were in during this time period. The Black Hawk band was allied with the British, yet they were inside a U.S. Territory, and you can imagine the tensions that that created here in our region. And the Sauk, Fox, and Meskwaki originally likely came from lower Michigan, ended up in Wisconsin, and I believe in the 1600s in the Fox Valley, eventually migrated down into the southern part of the state. And the Black Hawk War really is a tragic story of what happened to this particular band of these people. But I'm familiar with Trask's book. It's a very well-written and a great story about this part of our past in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Thank you, David, for calling. Bill in Boaz, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I have a question. I'm about 6 miles northwest of the Boaz Mastodon site.
Okay.
And on my property, I have a 40 to 60-foot gully that runs up from my property below up to the ridge, and there's a lot of worked pieces of flint in the area. And when they built the house that I presently live in, there's a lot of this scattered around. I've got picked up buckets full, but I can't find any, you know, artifacts like knives or that sort of thing. And I'm wondering, is there any value to these sites or...
Well, it is great value. The Boaz Mastodon is a very significant site. It's one of the few well-preserved Ice Age elephants that's been discovered in the state and excavated by the University of Wisconsin-Madison. It's on display at the Geology Museum in Madison and may have been connected with Native peoples. There was allegedly a fluted early Paleo-Indian stone point that was found with the mastodon. This was excavated before 1900, so it was before we knew that there were connections between human beings and Ice Age mammals in our region. But that area has a significant amount of archaeology. There are resources of people you can contact, the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, the Mississippi Valley Archaeology Center at UW-La Crosse has a very active program that extends down into the Richland area. Our campus here at the University of Wisconsin, Baraboo Sauk County, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the Wisconsin Historical Society, and the State Archaeologist's Office. These are all people where there are archaeologists who are working in this part of the state would be very interested in learning about your discoveries.
Okay. Well, maybe I could get a hold of people at La Crosse then, if that would be the most
probably the closest.
Efficient, or I could give you a call sometime when you
sure.
have time.
Sure. I would encourage you, if you have access to the web, to just go to the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse website and type in archaeology, and you'll find a connection to the Mississippi Valley Archaeology Center there. But I'd be happy to talk with you as well.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Tom in Luck, Wisconsin. We go to you now. Hi, Tom.
Hello. Say, I've got a question. I've got a piece of bone that I found that appears to be a tibia. It's rather large. So here's my question. This piece of bone has the consistency of stone now. What I'm curious about is how long would it take for a piece of bone to become somewhat petrified? In other words, what would be the youngest
the process that you're asking about is fossilization, which we're getting now into a paleontology and geological topic. Fossilization is where the organic component of bone is replaced through a mineralization process, and full fossilized bone can be almost entirely turned to a stone-like consistency. But the mineralization process can begin. We've seen, for example, Ice Age elephant remains come in that are partially mineralized, where they're not turned entirely to a fossil, but yet the mineralization process, this process leading to that, is already starting to take place. It's something I'm not an expert in, but I can tell you that in Wisconsin we have seen animal remains dating to the end of the Ice Age where this mineralization process is already well underway, but yet we're not dealing with fossilized bone.
Hmm. What I'm trying to eliminate is the possibility that it's some, 200 to 300-year-old butchering site, you know, that perhaps Europeans would have been responsible for.
What would be important would be to have the species identified as to what type of animal you're dealing with. If it's a domesticated animal, then it's something that's post-European contact. So if you're dealing with a horse or cattle, something like that. But if it's not one of those species and it's something native to the region, then it could potentially be prehistoric. And, of course, if it's something that dates to the end of the Ice Age, a species that's now extinct, gives us some immediate indication as to its antiquity and age. Sources of places where you might be able to go to: the Milwaukee Public Museum, the Kenosha Public Museum in Kenosha, both have Ice Age mammals on display and have someone there that could potentially point you in the right direction as to getting this identified.
The other question I've got is, how long would it take for the impression of a tomahawk to be formed into a piece of granite?
I think what you're asking is about the process for manufacturing a stone axe.
No, I've got a piece of stone where you can see the outline of a tomahawk in it. The tomahawk is not there.
Okay. I'm not sure without looking at the piece, but we know that Native peoples made axes and adzes and things like tomahawks or tomahawks out of ground stone, which is a process that involves pecking and grinding. It was intentionally done by Native peoples, and where they would peck and grind away the surface to produce the axe. It's a fairly lengthy process, but something that can be accomplished by a person certainly within several days' time of applying that this pecking and grinding and polishing process, depending upon the size of the tool and what the end product is going to be.
Hmm.
The odd thing about this is it's not just the head of the tomahawk, it's also the handle is impressed into this piece of granite.
Yeah, it'd be very unusual to see a monolithic type form where the handle and the axe are one piece. That's very rare and occurs only in certain types of cultures in late prehistory.
Yeah, this thing, it's just puzzling as to how it could have, how that impression could have gotten into that hard a piece of rock.
You might want to go to the Milwaukee Public Museum with that and take a look and see what they think. It'd certainly be worth following up, wouldn't it, Tom?
Yeah, it's something that you could. Another possibility would be to take some digital photographs of it, and you could send a photograph to me or to the state archaeologist or to another archaeologist to at least look at it to see whether it'd be worth bringing it in for a specialist to take a look at.
Yeah, that's a good idea. What's your address?
My address is Thomas, T-H-O-M-A-S. Plager, P-L-E-G-E-R, at uwc.edu, or you can just go to the University of Wisconsin-Baraboo Sauk County website, www.baraboo.uwc.edu, and just search on my name or type in archaeology, and you'll find me or the dean's office.
All right. Thanks again, Tom. Ruth in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Ruth.
Hello. How are you today?
Good.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I am enjoying your program very much. I just wanted to comment on a previous caller's question regarding the Wabik Mound area.
Yeah.
That is located in Pepin County near Ogalle. The reason I know about it is that my great-grandparents homesteaded in that area of the county. And my dad always told stories about the fact that when they were farming the area, they were continually turning up Indian artifacts, arrowheads and things like that. They did not know at the time the value of that area, and they found later that their farm area was situated on Indian Mound.
Oh.
That area has now been protected, and I believe it's called the Bradshaw Mound.
The Bradshaw Mound.
Well, I appreciate the call and the information. Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling, Ruth. Appreciate your call. And Tom, thank you so much. Always a pleasure. Look forward to another visit from you.
Thank you, Larry. Always a pleasure to be on the show.
Tom Plager is Dean and Campus Executive Officer and Associate Professor of Anthropology and Archaeology at the UW-Baraboo Sauk County Campus. So great to have him along. I'm sure down the road we will talk again about the archaeology of our state. But we're going to turn our heads skyward coming up next and take a look at stargazing. And maybe talk about the Perseid meteor shower as well, because that's coming up too. Paul Kinzer of Galesville, Wisconsin, our guest coming up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.